Hi, I'm Dahlia Lithwick, legal correspondent, author, and host of Slate's Amicus Podcast, a show about the rule of law, the law, and the Supreme Court justices who interpret it for the rest of us. I've been watching the High Court for over two decades, and I bring all that experience and knowledge to examining the U.S. justice system and democracy. Each episode, I am joined by guests with deep knowledge of the law and policy who help me and you navigate our constitutional landscape. Slate's Amicus Podcast. Subscribe now wherever you listen.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the White House Office of Management and Budget Director, Shalonda Young. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write in at politicswarroom@gmail.com. or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, ExpressVPN and Henson Shaving, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, James, it's coming home for Donald Trump. Special Prosecutor Jack Smith almost certainly is on the verge of the mother of all indictments, the former president's role in trying to stage a coup to overturn an election culminating in the January 6th insurrection. A couple points. We think we know a lot about what occurred January 6th and before, in large part due to the January 6th committee. However, we thought we knew a lot about the classified documents case. But Smith's indictment brought out a lot more really damaging stuff, the way Trump tried to conceal documents, instances of revealing sensitive information to outsiders, classified information, and that he knew what he was doing was illegitimate. And I think it's a pretty safe prediction that we're going to learn more and more shocking stuff about Trump post-2020 election, which he lost clearly, definitively, when this indictment comes down. I think the second major point to look at is who has cooperated with Smith in a high level against Trump? Rudy Giuliani, his former lawyer, Mark Meadows, his former chief of staff, or Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, all testified before the Smith impaneled grand jury, all knew a lot about Trump and what he was doing, and all have two powerful incentives to cooperate and tell the truth, A, to save their own skin, and the knowledge that loyalty is a four-letter word to Trump. He's loyal only to himself, and if the shoe were on the other foot, he would not hesitate a moment to cut them loose. And let's not forget, just as a quick afterthought, a probable indictment in Fulton County, Georgia, for trying to overturn that state's election also is almost imminent. James?
Well, I watched Trump last night at Sean Hannity hit it at Cedar Rapids, rally. And you get, again, those people look and act so normal, and the whole thing is so literally insane. And I just want, I agreed that they're going to indict him on January 6th. They're going to have specifics in the indictment that are going to be, I didn't know that, and oh my God, and it'll be a speaking indictment, as they call it on cable TV. And I guess I'm like anybody else. It's going to be horrific. He's a criminal. We've known that. Is it going to matter? I don't know. Nothing has mattered so far. I mean, the stuff that they in classified documents, nuclear secrets, you name it. To just dig in deeper, and I don't know. It's so insane. It's so crazy. He's so guilty. He's so crooked, and they don't care.
Yeah, I have been in that. I've held a rather minority, to put it mildly, position that's all going to catch up to Trump and his support. Both he will have trouble dealing with it at some point. His support will start to diminish some. So far, that's been absolutely not the case. This is the big test. If it doesn't happen this time, it ain't going to happen. I think the Trump defense was captured perfectly, James, by Wyoming Senator Cynthia Lummis. And here's what she said the Trump indictment would reveal. Quote, I quote Cynthia Lummis, "It shows that politicians lie and they know they're lying. The liar knows that people know he's lying, and the people that are being lied to know they're being lied to." I think that captures Trump world perfectly. I don't know what will happen. I'm not going to back off of my prediction yet, but we're going to look for polls to come out around September 7th to 10th, and we'll see if he hasn't started a crater by then, and I still think he will, then he's not going to. And if he hasn't, I'm going to replicate what James Carville, after an election loss, did 30 years ago and put a trash can over my head. Because if it doesn't happen by September 10th, it ain't going to happen. And I would just add, and James, you can pick up on this because you've been saying this for a long time. Conversely, if Biden is still running even with Trump after all this, there's going to the quiet panic in Democratic ranks is going to get a lot louder. And there are going to be people looking at places like, you know, East Lansing, Michigan to say, man, we need somebody to get in this thing.
Yes. I mean, I think that the fate is everybody is in. It's a Biden-Trump rematch. And that's where everything is going. And the important week is that, you know, Labor Day is, I guess, the 4th of September this year. That kind of from the 4th to the 12th is going to be 8 big days in American politics. Because you're right, if nothing has changed and he's still 45-45 in a trial heat and Biden's still at 42 approval, they're going to be some earthquakes. And everybody is writing it, even John Chait, you know, who I'm crazy about, is, you know, everybody's trying to figure out when is he going to start getting credit for it. The economy and the optimistic view is we're starting to see some gain, particular gains, real wage is for hourly workers. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, that's the argument that there's a lag time, and there is a little bit of a lag time, but that lag time's getting, you know, pretty long.
Right. The question that haunts everybody, people just, giving up.
Right.
He's too old.
They're saying he's too
old.
You know,
I don't know.
We were with a group of people last night. I think almost all, not all, but almost all were Democrats would vote for Trump. And the pessimism, except for the Trump people who didn't participate, the pessimism in conversation was extraordinary. And somebody really smart said, you know, it's not easy. It's embarrassing to get old in front of your family and your friends. But damn, imagine getting old every day visibly in front of the world. And if that's the continued perception, it's a problem. James, let me ask you this. If Trump does start to deteriorate, if maybe I'm right, if maybe, and DeSantis seems to lose support every time he campaigns, what GOP dark horses are there out there?
Well, if Trump starts to lose, the first thing that I think requirement is going to be, you can't be somebody who is running against Trump, because they view, and people are going to stay in this, is Trump's going to get indicted. Our guy is under attack. How dare you withdraw his attention from fighting the deep state and the rev? So if they have to look to somebody else, it's going to be somebody who's never crossed Trump and is not in the current field. And I think that person most likely would be J.D. Vance, because he's ambitious enough and he's flexible enough, as he showed in the Senate race, they're not going to go to Ron DeSantis. Trust me. They're mad at him. It doesn't matter how many woke people he gets rid of or puts in jail or all the stupid crap he does. They don't like him. He touched the king.
Yeah, they don't like him. And, you know, even separate from that, voters don't like him. My friend Tom Rath up in New Hampshire said every time he campaigns, he loses votes. Last night, James, you've been around politics for a long time. Have you ever heard of a politician who, after he speaks, needs his wife to close so it looks better?
You know, I think a lot of people saw him and saw his election win, which was impressive. You know, let's not forget that. And he looked to score some early points on these hot button issues. The problem is he couldn't get from out under it, and he couldn't get from out under the stories that Susie Wiles was planning on him left and right. And the guy doesn't have any fallback skills. I mean, it's got to be terrible for him to be out there campaigning. Obviously, not only does he not like it, he might have some kind of a medical condition that makes him uncomfortable around people. And that's kind of hard to run in the New Hampshire primary at Iowa caucuses and be uncomfortable around people.
It sure is, and maybe even more so in New Hampshire, which, you know, the old line up there was, are you going to vote for so-and-so? I only met him three times.
Right.
So, I don't know how DeSantis revives. He had a long interview with Jake Tapper yesterday, which didn't seem to do much. But in any event, well, big week this week, and man, the next couple of weeks, James, are going to be colossal. And we will just have to see how it goes. Hey, James, our guest is the director of the Office of Management and Budget, Yolanda Young, whose knowledge and skill as a former top appropriations staffer was the key in the debt ceiling negotiations that avoided a catastrophic default. Her Louisiana roots may be of some interest to you, James. We'll get to that. But first of all, Madam Director, those were tough negotiations. But House Republicans already are saying, I'm sorry, we're not going to go along with them. There have to be deeper cuts and in the appropriations bills and in any continuing resolution. Is there any room for compromise here?
Look, Al, I spent a few weeks without a lot of time with my child and certainly not time to even get dry cleaning done. We have compromised. We've had those negotiations. A deal's a deal. It is not unusual for the House and Senate to have their own processes to work out members' feelings. And that's what's happening now. The Senate, on the other hand, which we can't ignore, is running a bipartisan process. Chair Patty Murray and Vice Chair Susan Collins are working in a collaborative way. So we're going to see what the House comes up with, but a deal's a deal. All you got is your word in this town, and we're going to keep chugging along, and we have until October 1st to make sure we fund the government, and that's what the president expects for everyone to hold up their end of the bargain here.
Yeah, but if those, I call them crazies, if those right-wingers who just demand more, and Kevin McCarthy knows he's in peril anytime he crosses them, If they persist, there's likely to be a government shutdown. What would be the consequences of that?
Look, I've been in this town long enough and done a lot of spending bills and seen majorities come and go who think shutdowns are good political tools. And guess what? We come to the table, we reopen in some reasonable manner with a bipartisan deal. So we get there one way or another. The question is do you think putting the American people through that is a good idea? We do not. And frankly, the debt deal established a process that would help prevent all of that. And so I still have some faith. I'm kind of an optimist here. I don't know why I'm an optimist in this town, but I am an optimist that the Senate process looking the way it does, that we're going to find a way to get there without doing harm to the American people with I like to call it the coalition who wants to govern. So there is a small group who may not, but there is a coalition of members I know well from both parties that want to find a way not to have this drama.
Let me ask you about one more, which could create problems in the Senate too, and that's the Ukraine supplemental funding measure. Some Senate Republicans are saying, okay, but it needs to be accompanied by additional defense spending above the cap in the debt deal. And some Democrats come back and say, okay, if there is more for defense, there's got to be an equal amount in addition for domestic spending. That's even before you get to the House. How are you going to navigate this almost certain
request for a Ukraine supplemental?
You heard the president of the G7. Our commitment, it's not just Ukraine. It really is, can the West stand up to an authoritarian state who has just decided they're going to invade a neighboring country in modern day times? This is no less than the West sticking together to push back on that just very idea. And it's dangerous if we allow that to go unchecked. And again, the majority of members, and I want to thank Congress, has been there every time we have asked for funding. So sure, there are people who do not believe that this is a worthy goal, but there are more people in Congress who agree with the president that this coalition is not only about Ukraine, it is about establishing the West, establishing NATO for future generations as a firewall between what Putin and his Russia stand for and what we stand for.
And then eventually those supporters who may want more defense spending or more domestic spending, you believe will give in on this Ukraine supplemental because the issue is so important?
Yeah, look, the debt deal never precluded funding for things outside of the normal budget process. We've always had to utilize supplementals for disasters, for example. I'm looking at you, James Carville, Louisiana. We would never take our optionality to have funding to make sure we address communities in this country who might need us. We're in the middle of hurricane season. Something could happen. So the debt deal was never meant to preclude Congress and this administration from acting on things outside of the normal budget process. And that includes Ukraine, which has been above and beyond the regular budget process. And that commitment, again, you heard the president of the G7, has never been stronger.
You know, the director, James, was born in Zachary, Louisiana, raised in Clinton, went to Loyola and Tulane. Does that ring any bells for you, James?
Well, she goes from Northeast Baton Rouge Parish to East Louisiana Parish to Orleans Parish, all part of my stomping grounds here. But I'm glad you brought that up, Al, because the OMB director, probably easily one of the 10 most powerful positions in the entire United States government. And so on to you, a long time appropriations committee, which is, I'm sure, one of the most powerful committees there are in the United States Congress. In everybody that I talk to pays homage, not only to your budgetary expertise and your line item stuff, but people to a point say, man, she's smart. She can really read a room, which is, I can assure you, anybody here, I'm sure Al, a veteran, can too. Reading a room is the most important skill you can have in Washington. if you can't read a room, I don't care how smart you are, you're not going anywhere. But tell us, having said all this, which is demonstrably true, tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what childhood was like, and what's a nice little girl from Zachary like you doing in a position like this.
I'm still trying to figure it out. The girl from Clinton. Clinton. I didn't know what an appropriations, office of management and budget. When young people ask me, what piece of advice? You know, I've never been a subscriber of 5, 10, 15 year plans. When you grow up where I grew up, we didn't know anything. We didn't know what these institutions were. Why would one limit themselves to the world you knew? I wouldn't be anywhere because I didn't know these things existed. I mean, so I tell young people, like, yeah, you should have a goal to go to college. You know, I picked DC because I thought it was interesting and I visit a friend and had a good time. But like the Appropriations Committee call, everybody was scared of him when I started in the government. I was like, who are these people? I want people to be scared when I call. You know, I kept my options open and kept my ears to the ground. And you read a room, I can take, there are lots of smart people in this town. I like to hire people who have some common sense, as my grandmother would say. Like, book smarts are fine. You need some basic level of knowledge about very important things. But if you don't have common sense, you can't make it far in this world, and I'd rather do without that. So I try to have a little common sense because my grandmother told me that was a lot more important than what you can read in a book. And reading a room is about common sense. If somebody looks like they're having a bad day, it may not be the day to talk to that person. It might be the time to talk to the person sitting next to them, because everybody has their stuff. So, you know, regular folks do well in DC because, you know, human nature is human nature. And these negotiations are about human nature. And you can go in with all the facts and figures you want. You kind of have to know what people care about and what they need to come out. And you have to know what the speaker is dealing with. And as Al pointed out, what a tough job he has. It's not just my job to know what we're trying to get to. I need to know what he needs to get his members to go along with this. And so I like to consider myself not just Democratic vote counter. I'm pretty good at assessing what the Republican vote count will be as well, because you have to if you need something to pass the House of Representatives.
Well, and as I understand it, on the Republican side, was your fellow Baton Rougean, Garrett Graves, who y'all did some tough negotiating together. But
My parents' congressman.
Your parents' congressman. only an American. You know, of course, Garrett's famously from South Baton Rouge. You grew up in the northern part of the parish. And I'm struck, and also Ambassador Greenfield, who was from Baker. This means nothing to people that are not you and I, but Baker and Zachary are one world. South Louisiana is another world. But
yeah.
You have these two enormously successful Black women from basically around the same place. And, you go on your career and you've done so, accomplished so much. And do you get time to talk to young people about what the possibilities are? And you're a busy person, but you've had an inspirational life. Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, every chance I can. And look, Linda Thomas Greenfield is one of those people for me along the way. Right. I was a young congressional staffer. That's how I went around the world. I hadn't gone anywhere until I started working on the Appropriations Committee. And guess what? We fund things all over the world. If we fund them, we went and looked at them. And I went with members of Congress, bipartisan members of Congress, and we stopped in Liberia. And Ambassador Thomas Greenfield was our ambassador in Liberia. And she clearly read everyone's biographies. And I get on the bus, she was like, "You're my homegirl." and I was like, "Now what now?" And this she's larger than life in Liberia.
Of course.
People looked up to her. She gave this great speech about reconciliation. And really, you're wearing a shirt that says LSU. She talked about in Liberia, given all that they had gone through with the Civil War, her experience at LSU as a student. That stuck with me. I retold her that story when we became colleagues. She is a force to be reckoned with. And to think about, you're right, this Black woman from Baker, Louisiana, as our representative in the United Nations, speaks as much for Louisiana, where she's from, her own family, but it speaks to this country that's our representative on the world stage.
Well, you know, one of the things I've noticed, I've spent a lot of time in Louisiana, spent time all over the country in Washington, is, and of course, you proved my theory to be too, is the able people in Louisiana is able people anywhere I've ever been in the world. And so often people, you know, but you have done, and Ambassador Greenfield has done, I mean, Lisa Jackson's done, Donna Brazile's, you could go on and on about Black women, you know, who are at the very top of the talent game anywhere you want to look at it. And I just think you bring great credit to the Biden administration. I think you just bring awesome credit to the state of Louisiana. I so admire the work you're doing.
Well, you're the institution again. No one has given me a fancy nickname like Raging Cajun, but I aspire.
I think maybe his reputation is being savvy and smart. Go ahead.
All right. And my role as the dull straight man, let me ask you just two more quick questions. I know you're dealing with the current budget, but next year is a huge one. The Trump tax cuts, a whopping $3.5 trillion over a decade if extended. Is your instinct now they should be extended or they should not be?
Like, the president has been clear about this, Al. You know his pledge. No one making under $400,000 in this country should pay more in taxes. Those over $400,000should pay more in their fair share. But when we extend those below $400,000, we should pay for those. If you care about the deficits in this country, which people like to say they do, then we have to find a way to pay to extend the tax cuts for those making under $400,000. We're committed to doing that, just like we're committed to not raising taxes on those under $400,000. We're committed to pay for that extension. And we call on everybody who claims they're fiscally responsible in this town when that deadline comes up. We hope their fiscal responsibility extends to tax cuts. You know, when the 2017 Trump tax cuts were passed, not paid for. And we have to, in our tax code, have the discipline to pay for those things just as we do for any other spending.
One more, Social Security. The experts say that in 10 years that the reserve fund will dwindle and retirees would only get a percentage of what they're due unless something is done. Nothing's going to be done, obviously, until after the election. But just in a broad sense, what do you think could or should be done to rectify that?
You two have been in this town a long time. You know, I wish we did not do it this way, but you know we do. Deadlines matter in this town. And in 2033, when the Social Security problem comes to a head, you know, there's going to be a lot of effort and ways to extend the trust fund. I hope we can start working on that sooner rather than later. But my experience tells me deadlines are a helpful tool in Washington. We're not going to let benefits be cut. I think both parties know that can't happen. But we do have to have a better political climate, because you cannot fix Social Security or Medicare without both parties coming together without trying to score political points. And that political space has to be had for us to find a solution, because we have to extend beyond 2033. We cannot ask people to pay into a system their entire lives to pull the rug out from under them. So I expect both parties will find a way to the table to find bipartisan solutions. The question is when. I certainly hope it's long before the 2033 timeframe. My experience tells me it'll probably be closer to.
I want to say one more thing before letting James close, and that is, it goes to you. My nephew is a Republican staffer on the Appropriations Committee. And after these negotiations, he told me there was one constant during those negotiations that he was told of. And I said, what was that? He said, everyone in the room, and there was a lot of polarization in that room, everyone in that room trusted Shalonda Young. That, I can't think of any higher compliment to pay to someone involved in a negotiation like that.
We Louisiana people are trustworthy. I think we're a trustworthy bunch. Again, I go back to, in this town, all you got is your word. And all you can do is be fair to people. You can have your position and you should not give up on your values. But if the American people are not your guiding light and all you care about is your position and not trying to find a solution, then budget battles are not where I hope you find yourself, because you need people who are willing to work on solutions and not default, which would have hurt millions of Americans, and not shut down the government. So we'll find a way in the middle, hopefully, in the next couple of months as we have to continue government funding.
Well, I'm sure you learned it back in Zachary and Clinton, but also starting to work for someone like David Obey was a great lesson. That's in right. The importance of trust in what you do. James Carville, you got a couple more.
I'm so proud of Shalonda, what she's done, and you know, all of the young people from Louisiana that show exactly, you know, the talent of our people, and more importantly, show our own people. You know, and I just think, and I hope Shalonda will, because she understands her unique role along with Ambassador Greenfield and other people. to keep being out there and being an inspiration to these young people, in particular these younger girls, that they can, there's no reason in the world they can't aspire to be at the very top of the United States government or any other place that you want to be. So I'm just very proud to have you on the show, Sandra, and give you all the best. And I'm gonna be pulling for you every inch of the way.
Yeah, public school from kindergarten to graduation and high school.
Where'd you go to Zachary? How are you, East Louisiana?
No, I went to Clinton. Clinton no longer has his own school because you have a bunch of cuts. They combined into a parish school. So Clinton Elementary, Clinton Middle, Clinton in ninth grade, and moved to Scotlandville Magnet High.
Back you went to Scotlandville Magnet High School.
Yep.
Right. Well, that's great. Well, whatever. Right. You know, public schools, and you were educated in your home state, and you made your home state enormously proud.
Thank you.
I hope one day you come back and run for governor.
I'll leave the political side to you.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
From what I hear, you have pretty good political instincts, Madam Director. Shalonda Young, thank you so much for being
here. Thank you so much. And give your family a hug for us.
You two are in very comfortable spaces that make me very jealous. but yeah, I'll see you on an airplane, I'm sure, at some point, going back and forth to Louisiana.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you both.
Hey, James, normally we do a segment on voter suppression with the invaluable assistance of the Brennan Center. This week, however, I want to do something else. I want to mark the 75th anniversary of one of the most important speeches that changing history paved the way for more universal voting rights. It was brilliantly captured by my good friend Dick Moe in a column in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. It was the 1948 Democratic Convention in Philadelphia facing a tough presidential election, and Democrats were struggling with the issue of civil rights. The answer came from a young mayor of Minneapolis, Hubert H. Humphrey, who in a ringing declaration implored that, quote, the time has arrived for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights, end quote. As my friend Dick Moe wrote, we should reflect on that moment today, that courage again today. And those voting suppressors who try to say this is about states' rights ought to be forced to go back and read Hubert Humphrey's 1948 speech. I don't know if it'd make any difference, but it's worth everyone doing. Go back and read that speech, July of 1948 in Philadelphia, Hubert Humphrey on civil rights.
So there's a book out, just came out on this very topic. And I think the guy's name is Samuel Friedman, and he's an academic, and he's got a whole book, and Into the Bright Sunshine, I think is the name of the book. And what really affected Humphrey was he was actually a graduate student at LSU, and he saw what segregation was up close on a massive scale. And that had I know where he lived in Baton Rouge when he was there, and that really jolted him and had a lot to do with giving that speech.
And for the next 30 years, there was no better champion of civil rights and voting rights than Hubert Humphrey. He would hate to see.
And that was courageous by any stretch in 1948.
It sure was. Listen, there were several delegations. I know Mississippi, I'm not sure about Louisiana, walked out of that Philadelphia convention.
We had to. Yeah. There's no way we were not that stupid.
Yeah. Hey, James, No Labels bills itself as a serious, substantive, possible alternative to Donald Trump and Joe Biden. They are raising a bunch of money, and this week they put out their platform. Here's what we stand for. If you had any doubt that this was a sham and a scam, read this 63-page poll-tested platform designed to please everyone not on the far right or the far left. On energy, No Labels says we need to focus on renewable energy while also retaining fossil fuels. Oh, okay. On abortion, No Labels says we need to respect a woman's right to choose, and we also need to respect the sanctity of human life. And please don't set any specific time frame upon which abortion is legal or not. Social Security, no label says, needs overhaul, but don't touch anyone at or near retirement age or the middle class or the less fortunate. And on national security, now, James, this is, you want to talk about courage. New Labels forthrightly declares in their platform, quote, a world led by America is safer, better than a world led by Russia or China.
Mm.
Wow.
Let me noodle on that.
And you might think that they would duck the difficult issue of budget deficits.
No.
Daring to be bold, they call for a blue ribbon commission.
Oh, my. I never had those before.
Oh, my God. No Labels.
Never heard of such a thing.
No Labels. You're on the cutting edge of I don't know what. Go ahead, James.
You know, it's as vapid and shallow as you would think it is. And look, they're going to go out and raise this money from these millionaires and all the Democrats. It's an evil organization, et cetera, et cetera. I think given this level of stupidity that they put out, let's just take them at their own word. Is this what America is looking for? You know, no solutions, no labels, no solutions, no problems, no nothing. I mean, it's saying, you know, I very rarely, I want to say never, but, you know, I seldom say never. Talk about stupid stuff that Trump says, because he says so many stupid things. And you just get frustrated because it doesn't change anything. I mean, like nuking a hurricane, right? Or putting disinfected directly on the human lung. And, all right, it's crazy. Or protecting the airports during the Revolutionary War. Right. It's really insane, but you could see if somebody were like just having a drunken conversation, why don't you just go to a hurricane, why don't somebody just drop a bomb in there and blow the goddamn thing up, you know? Or there's no way you can get this out of but at least in some connection. So the Miles Taylor, I guess, was a deputy Homeland Security guy, said that when they meet with Trump and he told him that the ranches along the Rio Grande were really complaining, having trouble because the wall prohibited their cattle from drinking water. And so the guy, you know, says, well, you know, maybe we can cut a hole in a wall. And Trump says, no, 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 put ladders there and let them cross over on a ladder.
You're making that up, James.
I'm not making it up. I swear. I'm not making it up. and cows are notoriously clumsy. You have a cattle guard. I grew up raising cattle that like railroad tracks separated because they can't cross it. You know, you don't put a gate in. You just put a cattle guard and a cow will never cross
it. So you don't think they could climb that wall?
the idea, the visual of a cow climbing the wall, ladder, going back down the ladder, taking a sip out the Rio Grande, going back. I got just like, I had to read it three freaking times. Right?
Oh,
and again,
God.
I got to tell you that the idea of nuking a hurricane is massively stupid, but I'd see where somebody, a massively stupid person, could come up with that idea. And you know, putting Clorox on people's lungs, you know, doesn't make much sense to me. But if you were drunk enough, you might think of it. This you can't beat. This is a Ohtani home run. I don't know what the fuck it is.
It is. It is.
The cow's going up to get out of the hole, but you put ladders there and go over.
All right, James, now for the questions from our very, very smart, perceptive listeners. And they're more than we can get to. So if we don't get to yours today, please send it in for next week. Annie in Minneapolis says, don't we have some people who can take Joe Manchin out back to the whipping shed to knock some sense into him? I thought he was on our side, WTF. And I think she's talking about his No Labels pitch this week.
Well, first of all, how many Democratic judges did Joe Manchin vote for?
I think she's talking about the, just to read the question, she's talking about his flirting with no labels.
I think he's getting attention. I think if he thought it would help elect Trump, he might not do it, but I don't know. I don't know. And if they're flirting with everybody because they have these rich people giving them money and everybody's got to get in on the deal, you know?
James, somebody told me, I don't know, that this right-wing congressman or former congressman who's running against the governor, Jim Justice, who was widely thought to be the nominee who could easily beat Manchin, that there's a chance that this right-wing congressman could beat Justice, at which point Joe Manchin would be right back in the game.
Right. And I think he's probably keeping his powder dry.
Yeah.
But he and Justice fired Manchin's wife. That shit don't go over big.
That doesn't endear you to them, does it?
No, not really. Not really. And now, apparently they were very good friends at one time. But, I mean, Jim Justice used to be a Democrat.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, Laura in Peterborough, New Hampshire. She said, since the Democrats are not sanctioning the New Hampshire primary, my husband and I have decided to register as independents and vote for one of the Republican candidates. We'll wait and see who, aside from DeSantis, can throw a monkey wrench into the Trump MAGA plans. It seems like less of a waste of our votes. What do you think? I just wrote about New Hampshire. You know, first of all, I think Biden made a terrible mistake up there, and I think he could suffer an embarrassment. You know, the question is whether he's going to allow a write-in or he's going to sanction it. And if that happens, Laura, it may put you in a position of where you have to stay in the Democratic one and write in Biden. But if not, I think you're probably right. And I would say right now, as of today, write in Chris Christie. Chris Christie's not going to be the nominee, but you know, he's going to have a lot of fun. He's going to have a lot of fun in New Hampshire, particularly going after Trump, and DeSantis. And, I don't endorse candidates, but James, you may disagree, but
I think, first of all, I would do anything I could that could simultaneously hurt the Republican Party and help the Democratic Party at the same time. So I'd be very upfront with my motivation. And if it was me, I'd vote for Ron DeSantis. I think Ron DeSantis, if you got a general election, Chris Christie, he would be a strong general election campaign. I think DeSantis would be a particularly weak general election nominee for the Republicans. He's got no skill. His state is literally falling apart right now. And trust me, as soon as people figure out what's going on in Florida, you're going to see people going down and say, gee, the housing insurance costs are going through the roof. They can't find anybody to work down there. They're canceling conventions. I mean, the whole crazy-ass thing. So I actually think that DeSantis would be easier to beat than Trump, because Trump had, you know, if you got caught in the wrong side of a turnout game where you didn't have much Democratic enthusiasm, which appears to be the case right now, and you had off the chart Republican enthusiasm, you could distort that model and it could end up like 2016. DeSantis can't distort the model anymore. They don't like him, and he doesn't have the skill, the charm, or anything else to do it. So my recommendation, I would vote for DeSantis, being that is the vote I think that would help us the most.
Well, I hope you're right. I'm not, and I think he's been a terrible candidate. I still would worry a little bit about some guy running against Joe Biden who's 35 years younger. But
well, I'd worry about anybody running against him, but right. He's stuck. His abortion position is the most extreme you can have.
Yeah,
he's not going to get from under that.
Right.
James,
Rob in Hartsdale, New York, said on last week's show, you said the best issues for Democrats were guns and abortion. I don't think you quite said that, but you said they were good issues, and they should talk about those two issues. Rob says almost exclusively, which I don't think you quite said, but Rob says, what about climate change, and how about calling it the climate crisis rather than climate change?
Okay, so, Rob, you listened pretty carefully. Well, I was talking about when we talk about the Supreme Court, we should not talk about affirmative action or student loans.
Right.
We should just the abortion gun stuff is much more salient, much more popular, much more outside. Now, and I just make the point I make a lot of times. Politics is in part about what you say. If anything, it's a larger part about what you don't say. And that's a critical distinction here. So what was the second part of the question, Alfred?
The second part of Rob's very, very good question. What about climate change? How about going at the climate crisis rather than climate change?
Fine. The climate crisis is a little more direct. Using the word. When people say it's an issue, it is. It's going to be more of an issue when, by the time we get through this hurricane season. Oh, God, it's going to be sickening, let me tell you. And I think it can be effective as a part to show that they're just clueless of what's going around them. They don't see the gun violence. They don't see the climate crisis we're in. They don't see that there's 30 straight days of 110 or higher. They don't see these people are completely clueless. I think it can be packaged into a larger critique. In anytime you get them saying, well, it's variation, I'm not a scientist or something, that the thing that people are going to agree with you that the climate is changing. Now, where it gets sticky is, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, when you think of how much money is the most profitable enterprise in the history of man is the exploration, extraction, refinement, transportation of fossil fuels. They tell you how many hundreds of trillions of dollars. And the world is having to pay for this. And we are going to have some massive lawsuit. And you can see, we've already started to see it down here, where the insurance rates are literally, you can't afford them in Florida now. And why, somebody's going to ask, why is a homeowner absorbing a 400% increase in the insurance when the fossil fuel companies have made off like bandits and kept all the money and accept no responsibility? Because what's happening now is not normal, and they knew it.
Right.
And this is something that's going to be not our lifetimes, but not in a not very distant future. You're going to see massive, and you've already seen some, but they're just getting started on these lawsuits and how much they knew. I mean, when they get to discovery, it's going to be unfreaking believable.
It is. James, Carl in Sydney, Australia. We had a good contingent in Sydney.
You sure do. I ought to go down there.
Do you think homelessness is getting worse in the U.S., and what should progressives be doing here and in the U.S. and back in Australia to help? You know, you ought to, Carl, we had a great guest on a couple weeks ago who is the head of the federal homeless effort. And so you ought to go, listen to that. And I think it's getting worse in some places, but some places it's getting better. I think Karen Bass out in Los Angeles, who has one of the worst problems, is really, really working hard to change that. So it's a really sad problem, and there's all kinds of issues. Anyone who says it's all due to, to drugs, or it's all due to depression, or it's all due to this or that, is wrong. It's due to a multiplicity of things. And probably the best solution, Carl, is for homeless people, get them a home.
Yeah, that is. That's what they're trying to do now. You know, some of it is, I think, fairly can be laid at liberals' feet. Restrictive zoning laws wouldn't let people in, became too expensive. But in their building, I mean, they did build a lot of houses in California. It seems to be a problem in, like, California. Boston, Texas has a terrible problem, I know. And in Tennessee and places that don't have that, I suspect the Minneapolis climate probably helps keep their numbers down. But then it's a problem in New Orleans. And people don't want to hurt anybody or be cruel, but they don't like disorder. No one wants to sit at a light and have some guy come up and try to hit you up for 50 cents. It just doesn't work very well.
No, you're absolutely right. John in Chicago, Illinois. This is for you, James. Instead of picking fights with drag queens and denying climate change, Governor Ron DeSantis has failed to address the property insurance crisis that has hit Florida. The major insurance companies are leaving. His denial of climate change is making Florida unaffordable for so many. Will DeSantis be able to counter this on the debate stage?
Well, first of all, thank you, thank you, thank you. As Albert knows, I've been preaching about this recently a lot. And no one has figured, you have in Illinois, maybe I'm sure you maybe have relatives down there or something. No one here has figured out how giant a problem this is and how it affects everybody. Remember something about homeowners insurance. You have to maintain that to maintain your mortgage. So let's assume you live in Florida, you're a dental hygienist married to a sheriff's deputy. You got two kids, right? And your homeowner's insurance was, you got a mortgage of $350,000, right? And if your homeowner's insurance goes up from $1,000 a year to $10,000 a year, you got to pay it or you can't keep your mortgage. And that happens to everybody that has a home. And by the way, it happens to everybody that rents. Don't kid yourself. Been people that rent, so the landlord, she or he or whatever pronoun it is, has to keep that property insured to keep his loan alive. And what happens when the insurance rates go up to your rent? Well, duh, let's think. So then this is a growing problem. The other problem they have is the sense coming crazy, any immigration stuff that, and so they can't, agriculture is a huge part of the Florida's economy. They can't find pickers. They can't find people to work the crops, construction, people scared to go to work. How many roofers you have in Florida that don't have a proper papers? I couldn't imagine. And then people that make it go around. So you figured it out. Florida is a failing state right now, and people are going to come to figure that out pretty quickly.
Well, that could be a huge story, both economically, yeah, socially, and certainly politically. Brooks in Manhattan Beach, California. What are the must-win states for the Republican presidential candidates in the primary? If the states that each candidate must win in order to continue his or her campaign. For example, Brooks says, I believe that if Pence doesn't win the Iowa caucuses with their high percentage of evangelical participants, then he is pretty much toast. Let me get your thoughts on this. I think Mike Pence is pretty much toast today, Brooks. I just don't think there's a path for him. As a general proposition, it's been true in both parties. If you don't win in Iowa or New Hampshire, I'm sorry, you're gone, because somebody's going to win and they usually take the place. Obviously, Joe Biden on the Democratic side disproved that last time. I think it was probably sui generis, but we don't know. I certainly think it's true this time. If Donald Trump isn't defeated in Iowa or New Hampshire, then it's going to be hard to stop him. And if someone defeats him in one of those two states, then I think it's going to give them a real momentum for what comes next. But, like it or not, and Republicans are keeping with their old order, it goes Iowa and New Hampshire. Those are the first two states, and South Carolina is not quite as critically. The interesting part of South Carolina is if Scott and Haley are still in it, who does better in South Carolina? But that may be kind of a subsidiary issue. I just think keep your eye on Iowa and New Hampshire and whether Trump can win or not.
Well, if Trump were to now lose Iowa or New Hampshire, that would be an indication that his campaign had collapsed. Because he's way ahead. He's way ahead right now.
Yeah, particularly New Hampshire, because he lost Iowa last time.
Right. He lost Iowa to Cruz, but assume he finishes, within spitting distance, okay?
Yeah.
But if he loses New Hampshire, he's lost a lot of ground. Because he's got big leads everywhere. I go back to watching those people in Iowa last night at the Hannity Trump thing.
Right.
And that didn't look like a guy who was going to lose the Iowa caucuses to me. I mean, there were people, I mean, they were literally lined up shouting. And it's all so crazy, and the people all look so normal. That's what I couldn't get over. And it was just one freaking lie after another. They couldn't stop lying. And it's like, oh, now look what happened. Hillary, they didn't even investigate her emails. It was just, okay, everything's fine. You know, here it is. Like, oh, they didn't investigate the emails? Oh, my God. How stupid was I? But they just say the stupidest, most erroneous, goofy shit, and they just eat it up. Please tell us more lies. Please, sir, may I have another?
Well, it goes back to Cynthia Loomis. That's what they're all about.
Yeah.
Listen, this is the final question. This is from Barb in Mount Airy, Maryland. Now, James, this may hurt a little bit. As a great SEC fan, what are the odds that someone can primary Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville after he had to walk back his comments on white nationalists? He has not helped the intellectual reputation of the SEC football, James.
No, he's not. You know, everybody has something. You know, something embarrassing you got to deal with. And I say this about Tuberville. There's truth in packaging. He looks as stupid as he is. I mean, if you look at that guy, you go, geez, he's stupid. But the one that is his match, but she's got enough sense to not talk very much, is the one from Mississippi, the Cindy Hyde Smith. Ooh, man, this is one light biscuit here. Let me tell you. And she's going to have a race. I mean, I see what happens in the Mississippi governor's race, but, you know, people that listen to this show know that I certainly not going to proclaim Mississippi anything close to a blue state, but it's a lot less red than you think.
Well, she's up when? And she up in 24?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
I think she is.
That's one to watch.
I'm pretty sure I'm right. But somebody, you would have to double check because I'm not sure.
We'll get back to you on that next week. And as for Tommy, oh my God. Anyway, listen, keep those questions coming in. I know we didn't get to all of them. We'll try to get to them next week. They are so good. They're a highlight for us. So thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville. I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, ExpressVPN and Henson Shaving, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.